Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetirregulars.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 155. The annotated Leslie S. Klinger.
I heard of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street Irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, hello. Once again, welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Burke Walder.
And I can't believe we'll get to talk to Les Klinger once again, one of the Sherlockian dynamos out there, probably the leading engine in the world of Sherlockian scholarship and writing and editing and all the rest. I really don't know how he does it all.
Yeah, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Well, we are going to be welcoming Les to join us in just a minute. Before we do that, just wanted to remind you a few housekeeping notes. This episode is available at ihose.co/ihose155. That's all lowercase. You can find the show notes there with lots of links to the various works that we'll be talking about today. And, of course, the ability to donate to us, create a gift to help fuel the show through Patreon, through PayPal. And now, if you have a mobile device that you're listening to us on, we recommend using the Radio Public app, and they actually have a tip button or a tip program directly baked into the app where you can continue listening to us and show us your love and dedication while you're doing so. We'd encourage you to leave us a comment on the show notes or by sending us an email or on our Facebook, Twitter, Instagram accounts. All of those are I Hear of Sherlock in social media.
And you can call us. Call us anytime at 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. We will capture your voice, your questions, your queries, that note of bemused engagement in your voice, and may very well play it on the program.
And don't forget to stay tuned. At the end of the interview, we will be having our biweekly quiz called Canonical Couplets, where we will ask you to identify which story a particular stanza refers to. And if you are one of the correct respondents, we'll put your name into a drawing, and you have an opportunity to perhaps win some swag here from I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Yeah, I have my eyes on one of those gold bars that's in our safe.
Neville Sinclair will have something to say about that, no doubt. Well, there is lots of swag that you can get on WessexPress.com.
In the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex, we celebrate October 30th as Coronation Day, when Henry Tudor was crowned King of England at Westminster in 1485. But you don't need to fight the Wars of the Roses to unify your kingdom. not when you have your copy of Baker Street Rambles by Edgar Award winner Leslie S. Klinger. Essays that comprise his entire career as a Sherlockian scholar, everything from his first short story to his round-the-world book tour for the new annotated Sherlock Holmes. And it's available right now from our WessexPress.com. Oh, hushed October morning mild, thy leaves have ripened to the fall. Tomorrow's wind, if it be wild, should waste them all. Let the crows above the forest call, while you relax with a new book from the Wessex Press. Choose yours today. Ah, the change of seasons is always a wonderful time for our pals in the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex. If only I could make more progress. You know, I keep telling them, boil the water before you drink it. But, you know, they seldom listen to me.
I know. And I'm always concerned about them and, you know, burning their piles of leaves this time of year. I mean, that can not only be dangerous, but it can be an ecological nightmare as well.
Yeah, look what happened in Leicestershire. Oh, boy.
Well, we have the great pleasure of welcoming back Les Klinger to the program. Les has been a guest on a number of previous episodes of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, starting his journey with us on episodes 31 and 32, back when we used to split these interviews into two parts, lest you fall asleep during the middle of them. We had a delightful conversation with Les then about his annotations and his role in advising the Warner Brothers film crew and the Robert Downey Jr. films. Les then joined us again for a special episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere back when the Free Sherlock case was decided, and gave us kind of the legal turns around that, and then again joined us on episode 105 to talk about Echoes of Sherlock Holmes with his co-editor, Laurie R. King. And we are grateful to have Les back with us again, as you can hear, to talk about, well, a number of things. You know, you can't keep a good editor or annotator down. And Les has a number of books out in this calendar year, but of course has had a number out in between the last time we talked to him and now. To note, this year we've got Baker Street Reveries from our friends at Wessex Press. We've got In the Shadow of Agatha Christie. We've got Classic Crime Fiction of the 1920s. And coming up later this year, For the Sake of the Game, another volume of anthologies with Laurie R. King. Whew, that's a lot. Les, welcome back.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here, as always.
Well, we saw you not too long ago at the From Gillette to Brett 5 conference.
And what a nice conference that was.
Wasn't it really? You know, a breadth of speakers and of topics, obviously all related to Sherlock Holmes on the screen. What was your topic again? Remind us.
I was fortunate to do a filmed interview with Rob Doherty, who is the showrunner of the CBS TV series Elementary. I had actually done a similar interview with Rob back in 2012 for the BSI-sponsored conference at UCLA on Sherlock Holmes on the Screen. And at that time, Rob showed us the pilot. You know, we all had sort of fingers crossed that the show might succeed. And here we are. It's now 141 episodes have aired. Johnny Lee Miller has appeared as Sherlock Holmes in front of a microphone for more hours than any other actor in history. And there's 8 more episodes to go.
That's fantastic. What a great milestone.
Yeah. No, it was a terrific interview. It offered a lot of insight into process that went into this particular portrayal of Sherlock Holmes, this experience, this Sherlockian experience appearing on the screen, and a little, too, about the future. What we wanted to talk to you about is really sort of related to that. In the past, we've talked to you about your engagement with Sherlock Holmes, and you had pointed out that while you had never gotten into the collection of Sherlockian first editions, one of the things that happened early on was that you really acquired a lot of you acquired a Sherlockian collection of resource material, writings about the writings. And it was about 25 years ago, I guess, that you suddenly found yourself with a serious collection of scholarship. And your wife at the time suggested, you've got thousands of these books. Why don't you write something about Sherlock Holmes? And that sort of kicked off your Sherlockian authorship career.
She's been sorry ever since. She created a monster. Because it turned into a lot of books and a lot of travel. And it's been amazing. It's just been an incredible just change of my life that all started because Sharon said, why don't you go write something?
Yeah.
Well, and we know you've annotated Sherlock Holmes, of course, the new annotated Sherlock Holmes. Big fans of that. We reference it on our website all the time. But can you run down all of the other things that you have annotated in that kind of series?
Sure. Dracula, H.P. Lovecraft, the second volume of which is coming out next summer. Frankenstein, which came out last year, and then some what I would describe as sort of oddball books with the connivance of Baker Street Irregular Neil Gaiman. We did the annotated Sandman, the amazing 78-issue run of comics. And then in December of last year, I did annotated Watchmen with Dave Gibbons. This is the Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons classic graphic novel. And then, of course, this classic American crime fiction volume that is coming out, or that actually just came out. And the last of my annotated books so far is Neil Gaiman's novel American Gods. The annotated edition of that will come out next year.
That's extraordinary. Now, we certainly know through our associations with the Baker Street Irregulars and just by virtue of having his volume around for the last 50 years, that William S. Baring Gould creating the original annotated Sherlock Holmes, it really was his magnum opus. It was the work of a lifetime. And, of course, he was an annotator by nature as well. I think he also did, what was it, the annotated Mother Goose. There you go. So it seems like that once the annotator's gene gets into your bloodstream, it never leaves, huh?
You. I think you're right, Scott. I've thought about this, and it's the same itch scratching that happens when I go to the movies with my wife and sit there in the screening room talking to the screen, saying, look at this scene, and this scene is like this from another movie. And by the way, this relates to something else that we know from a previous film and so on. And, she's generally saying, could you just shut up? Let us watch the movie.
I didn't know I was going to the annotated film at 11.
What was it?
It's an offshoot. I always loved the game Trivial Pursuit. I was always really good at it. And to some extent, annotating is playing a huge game of Trivial Pursuit.
Well, you've talked in the past lightly about what led you to produce the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library, which then led to the Norton annotated edition. But what was it about Baring Gould's work that led you to say to yourself, there can be more done here or more needs to be?
It certainly wasn't a deficiency in Baring Gould. It was, I fell in love with the Baring Gould annotations. I got the book in 1968. It had been out for just a few months. I got it as a gift and I was hooked. It was the first time I had paid serious attention to Sherlock Holmes. I was a huge science fiction reader. I had not really read mysteries. And I had read, I'm sure I'd read a couple of Sherlock Holmes stories because we all had in high school. But I hadn't really paid attention to them. And then here was this book, and I discovered not only the depth of the materials, but I discovered that there was this whole group of fans, scholars, students of the Sherlock Holmes universe. And I wanted to be part of it. And my first urge was to be part by subscribing to the Baker Street Journal, which I did. I subscribed very early. I subscribed probably in 68 or 69. And for many years, that was sort of my participation. I read the journal. I ended up joining a local Sherlock Holmes club here in Los Angeles. I was a collector. Not a very serious collector, but a collector. And then at some point, as you mentioned, I decided that I could do more.
Now that's sort of a big deal. I mean, when you look at something like Baring Gould's Annotated, if you know, you look at that and say to yourself, what's next? You've got to delve into all of the source material. You've got to look at Victorian history. You've got to look at popular culture. How did you get your arms around that kind of a project?
Well, it started by reading Baring Gould very carefully and trying to look up his sources. I wanted to, in doing a reference library, I started with the stupid idea that I would take Baring Gould's footnotes and add on material. Fortunately, friends, Steve Doyle, Chris Roden, a couple other guys, looked at it and said, well, you can't do that. You got to write your own material. So I wanted to go back and find the source material that Baring Gould had used. And I did. I looked in some detail. And in most cases, he had cited where, this is the lawyer in me, he had cited his sources, not always, but I was in every case able to find where he'd gotten the material. In some cases, actually, and I say this with all with tremendous respect, because he died before the book came out, remember, there were long passages that were lifted out of other people's material without attribution. I am certain that had he lived, that wouldn't have happened. But so I rectified that in doing the reference library. I quoted generally at greater length from the original source materials that Baring Gould had used. And, you know, as I said, being a former law review type, put in detailed source attributions for all that stuff. But I also wanted to update those notes. I mean, Baring Gould came out, as I said, in 1967. I started this project basically in 1995, when there was almost 30 years of additional scholarship. Fortunately, and without two things, it would have been impossible to do that updating. One was the computer and of course, the internet. And that was the beginning of a lot of material being available in Google Books and elsewhere. And second, the DeWald bibliography. I mean, I always say I had three great advantages over Baring Gould. One was the DeWald bibliography. One was the internet / computers. And one was that I got to start with Baring Gould.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, this sort of gets us into the process. And you've now produced, as you mentioned earlier, or as Scott mentioned earlier, too, Annotated Dracula, the Annotated Frankenstein, which we want to talk about, H.P. Lovecraft, all these other things. So starting at the beginning, how do you go through sort of the most fundamental question in a task like this, which is deciding on the text? I mean, particularly in the case of the Holmes cases, you have the Strand Magazine editions, right. You have the American editions, you have the first editions, you have come up with the unified? And you got into this a little bit in Bloomington in your lecture about Frankenstein. How do you decide on the text of record?
Well, Frankenstein was a special case, and we can talk about that in a bit, but Sherlock Holmes was an interesting process. I mean, one of the things I did was, and this is the collector in me, I went out and bought every single Strand magazine that had a Holmes story in it, because mainly because I wanted the illustrations. and I wanted to scan them and use them in the book, and we did. I mean, I'm very proud that this is far and away the most illustrated edition of the canon ever produced. We had over 1,000 illustrations. But so I had the Strand magazine. I had the English text editions, the John Murray editions. I had the American text. I actually started with the American text. And I went through them very carefully. I think my wife and I proofread every single story against the English text, even though we were using the American text. And then I decided, first of all, what I liked, what I thought was sort of the better version. And second, I wrote footnotes about, or sort of stuck in footnotes about material differences in the text. There's also, I was also very fortunate, Newt and Lillian Williams, two of the founders of the occupants of the empty house in DuQuoin, Illinois, a vital little science society, created something that they called the annotated. They took Baring Gould and literally hand wrote into the text of Baring Gould textual variations. And Bill Cochran, bless him, sent me a photocopy of their master. Actually, he lent me their masterful book. I photocopied it and sent the original back. And I'm now lucky enough to actually own it. He sent it to me after they died. He sent me the original text. A magnificent work. So, yes, I mean, I spent a fair amount of time talking about the text. And I'm always quick to say, and I think I said this in the introduction, the text is my own. It's my own in the sense that I, without anybody's authority, made judgment calls about what the text should be. So it is not the English text. It is not the American text. It is not the Strand text. It is an amalgamation of all those that represented what I thought was the best text.
Huh. So what's an example of a judgment call? What's an example of your process in action there?
Generally, I would do things like I've spent a good deal of time over the last 20 years looking at Sherlockian manuscripts as well. And so it's looking at all those sources and trying to decide what represents probably the most authentic. And although it drives some people crazy, I love to play the game. It is a useful philosophy to approach the stories with the idea that these are true, as we know. Dr. Watson wrote them. And so in most cases, my preference would be the Strand text, because that is the closest in time to Watson's original notes. But the manuscript is even closer. So if there are significant variations in the manuscript, I want to look at what the manuscript said, because that is the most sort of contemporaneous of Watson's creations. And so I've written a great deal about manuscripts and spent a good deal of time worrying about the variations between the manuscripts and the printed texts. One of the things that fascinates me, and we don't really have the answer yet, as far as I know, there is only one galley in existence in the world of a Sherlock Holmes story. It's owned by our friend Costa Rosakis. I've forgotten which story it is. I think it's The Crooked Man. I've forgotten. And so when you do a comparison, and I do this in my legal world all the time, and so I was able to do it here too. When you do a computerized comparison of texts and you see that the published version in the Strand magazine or the published version in the book edition is different from a previous one, who changed it? We don't know. We don't know if it was some editor at the Strand. Was it an editor at John Murray, at Newness? Was it Conan Doyle himself? Was it Dr. Watson? We have no idea because we can't find. There's no indication of galleys, things being changed, and sort of editorial changes. We can't see that process, and that bothers me.
Well, have you seen Costa's galley? I mean, are there notes in that particular galley?
I'm not, and I'm saving that up. That'll be an interesting study at some point.
Are there other annotators? Is there a science society of Sherlockian annotators, or are there other people who've annotated works? For example, you know, one of the things that looms large for me is something, you know, I guess it's my own peculiar literary interests, is Ulysses, you know, because of the multiplicity of editions and the variations and Joyce's own handiwork on Ulysses, the idea of not necessarily an annotated Ulysses, but an uber text of Ulysses has always seemed very attractive to me. But are there other people who reach out to you from time to time and say, I'm thinking about annotating something, help me out? Or
yes. And I've been very fortunate that three of my books have been published by W.W. Norton, a publisher I just love working with. And so there's a little that they have now something like 20 annotated books in their series of annotated books. I've done, well, if you count 20, when I say 20, they've come out over 20 times. They're in all separate titles. So I've done two Sherlock Holmes, Dracula, Frankenstein, Lovecraft, and Lovecraft. And I'm tied, I think, with Maria Tatar, a professor at Harvard, who has done a series of annotated fairy tale books for them. And Michael Patrick Hearn, who did A Christmas Carol, The Wizard of Oz, Huck Finn, and is now doing Edgar Allan Poe for them. And then the rest of the books that they've done are typically one-offs. That is to say, the editors are people who were well-known scholars in that particular field. And so there's an annotated Pride and Prejudice. There's an annotated Secret Garden. There's an annotated Wind in the Willows, and so on. So there aren't very many annotators who kind of jump around. They tend to be scholars who are specialists in a particular field. And therefore, they actually know something, as opposed to me, who just makes it all up.
And have you talked to these folks? I mean, I can imagine a great cocktail party of Norton annotators sort of underwritten by a prominent manufacturer of index cards, I suppose.
We do know each other. We have chatted, but we've never sort of really talked about annotating and why it's in our blood and all that. That would be an interesting meeting, but it hasn't happened.
I would love to see the notes from that meeting.
Well, yes. And you know, I mean, I talk to other writers all the time, and I'm frequently on panels with other writers, some of them nonfiction writers, but mostly fiction writers. And it's always with a bit of wistfulness there that we talk about research. Every writer on earth, I think, loves doing research. The sad part for fiction writers is that they end up throwing away 90% of it, because if they put it all in the book, it's boring. I don't throw away anything. I've told the story, I don't know if I told it on the show before, about when I was doing Sherlock Holmes. I got a call from the senior editor at Norton that said, Les, you know, your contract requires us to have 8 pages of color images. We budgeted 1,200 pages for the first two volumes. You're at 1,900 pages. Do you mind if we don't do the color pictures? I was like, bless you. Thank you. Please don't make me get a single footnote. And they did.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's very clever.
Never said to me, your footnotes are too long.
Yeah.
I miss those color images, though. How about?
Well, we've made up for it in later volumes, right?
Oh, right.
Not Sherlock Holmes, but later volumes. So.
That's all right. Well, you know, one of the things that I certainly know your Sherlockian work for in the earlier days, Les, and this is going back probably to the 70s, is a work that you and Andy Peck embarked on together. Called The Date Being, where
yes.
You looked at a number of the chronologies, I don't know if it was comprehensive at the time. I know there's been
it was.
Certainly more it was. Since then, but
and,
yeah.
And you're being way too generous about the date. It actually came out in 1996. So.
Oh, really?
Yes. I had become friends with Andy, back in the 70s. We met through the Ides of Mohunk weekend, and the crowd that was Mickey Fromkin, Susan Rice, Henry Enberg, BSI, now deceased, Marlene Egg, some others, Barbara Ulian, Chris Steinbrenner, and Andy. These were all New Yorkers, hardcore New Yorkers, with the exception of Marlene. And Chris actually took me to the dinner in 1978 as his guest. And I must have done something wrong because I wasn't invited back. But in 1995, but I had become friends with Andy, and we kept that friendship alive for the next 20 years. And in 1995, he decided I needed to come to the dinner. So it's thanks to Andy that I got an invitation in 95, and the rest is history. But in any event, I was teaching a class on Sherlock Holmes by that point. I was teaching for UCLA Extension just because I enjoyed doing it. And I had come across Andy's masterful book, The Date Being, and said to him, you know, I'd like to update it. The original edition came out, I think, in the 70s, Scott. And I said, Andy, there's been, you know, like seven or eight more chronologies published since you did your work. Could I update the book? And he said, let me get this right. You're going to do all the work. I write a two-page introduction. We split the money, right? I said, yep. So we put out the updated Date Being in 1996.
That's
it. Which I believe covered 14 chronologies at that point.
Yeah. And it looks like on the copyright page that the original edition was in – it was copyrighted 1970 and 1973 by Andy Peck. So
right.
that would conform with your dates there. So interestingly, even your approach to chronologies was as an annotator, was to take, you know, the collection of chronologies that existed to date and to make sense out of them, compile them, and put them in some kind of format that allowed scholars and, you know, passive Sherlockians alike to browse through them.
That was the idea. And Andy had had the right idea to start. His mother had typed the whole thing. And when Andy met me and discovered that I actually knew how to word process, it was just a it was a marriage made in heaven. What can I say?
For those of our listeners, one of the things that brought all this to mind to me was that earlier this year, Henry Folsom passed away. And I'd gotten to know Henry through my many years of association with the Cornish Horrors. But Henry was, of his generation, a leading Sherlockian scholar. And in the 1960s,
absolutely,
published multiple editions of a chronology.
Right. And Henry, editions.
Yes, and Henry did this, you know, in the 1960s, sort of cut off from the larger Sherlockian world. So he was not aware of similar efforts. Could you just review for our listeners who might not, because chronologies is such a topic for Sherlockians. There are many Sherlockians who think this is like root canal, you know, the idea of looking at chronologies. When did the stories happen? Was it April 24th?
Right.
You know, this, then the other thing. But there are many, many more who find it fascinating. And over the years, you know, going back to Finley Crist and others, there have been many efforts along these lines.
Sure. Well, if you're going to seriously play the game, if you're going to take the position and wrap your arms around the idea that these are biographical accounts, then we want to understand the characters better, the participants in the story better, by looking at how the characters developed, what came before what came after that. I'm not sure that arguing about whether it's the night of April 23rd or the morning of April 24th is hugely different, but certainly the order of the stories is crucial to understanding the characters. And for example, some of the better uses of chronology are in, for example, June Thompson's wonderful biography called Holmes and Watson. She had her own chronology, and she used it to write a very compelling, very psychologically insightful biography of both Holmes and Watson. And of course, it was very important to understand what came before what to do that, to show how these men developed. So chronology has always been sort of inherently interesting to me. It is trivia to some extent. And you will notice that in my, both in the reference library and in the Norton edition, I cut out almost all of Beringel's footnotes about the weather and the phases of the moon and all that. He, too, was fascinated by chronology. And before he published The Annotated Sherlock Holmes, had published a book called The Chronological Sherlock Holmes. So I was interested in chronology, but not to the extent of sort of having it overshadow the other interesting things about the stories. So in both volumes, both sets of volumes, I relegated the chronological material to appendices where somebody can look at it if they're interested and see the variations and all that, but not to go through the detailed analysis. Another one of my favorite chronologies that's often overlooked is the Bradley Sargent book, Ms. Holmes, in which they suggest that Sherlock Holmes was a woman, and look at the dates in part because of how the monthly cycles are important for the biology of women. But it's a very sensible chronology, whether you buy that or not. There's also another one called the Biorhythmical Sherlock Holmes, in which someone, I've forgotten the author, attempted to work out chronology based on what he computed were the biorhythms of Holmes and Watson.
And we're just going to pause here a minute for a brief word from our sponsor. While the Baker Street Journal is a nominal sponsor of the show, a visit to the site bakerstreetirregulars.com will quickly show that, well, there's more available there than just the journal. You know, it's the home of the Baker Street Irregulars Press, where you can buy books with the best of the best. Scholarship from the ages, curated and edited into volumes that are ready for your bookshelves. One of the best-selling books of the BSI Press Pantheon is The Grand Game, a celebration of Sherlockian scholarship, Volume 1, 1902 to 1959. This ambitious project was undertaken and edited by Laurie R. King and Leslie S. Klinger and was originally published in 2011. It features some of the greatest early scholarship in the Sherlockian world, from pamphlets and scarce small prints to some of the first articles in the Baker Street Journal. The book has been long out of print, but we have news for listeners of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. The BSI Press has reissued The Grand Game Volume 1 as a trade paperback. The late Bernard Davies once wrote, "How wonderful to discover that even if you're slightly mad, you're not alone." And this book demonstrates well just how interesting it can be to play the grand game. So pop over to bakerstreetirregulars.com and get your copy today.
Yeah, now you mentioned earlier when we were talking about the master text for the annotated edition of Holmes that you made personal judgments and you described your methods. It's been a little bit overlooked, or I don't know overlooked, but I don't know that we've paid sufficient attention to it. In the autumn 2014 Baker Street Journal, you had a paper called A Consideration of Chronological Data, which to me seems to be a real milestone in all of this, because for the first time, you produced a consensus view of the chronological adventures of Holmes and Watson, presumably drawing on and guided by and influenced by all of those preceding chronologies, including your joint effort with Andy Peck. So absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about that? How did
Sure. Well, I mean, one of the things that interests me, Bert, is that although everybody wrings their hands and says there's nothing original to be learned about Sherlock Holmes anymore, now, the Golden Age was back in the 40s, maybe 50s, and everything's been written. In fact, it hasn't. There is a great deal of data that's out there that just hasn't been sufficiently analyzed. So one of the things, I'm not sure why it came up. I think it came up because I get a lot of emails. Lindsay Fay, bless her, labeled me the world's first consulting Sherlockian. And I love that title. And I get emails all the time, as recently as this morning, with questions about, can you tell me this? I don't get the could you write my term paper questions, but most of their questions from Sherlockians looking for something, looking for a bit of research or something. And I think somebody asked me about a date, and I said, I don't really know the answer offhand. I'm going to have to put some stuff together. And I had actually done my Norton annotated Sherlock Holmes, I had indicated what I called the consensus dates for each of the stories in a single footnote for each story. Consensus meaning that if you look at the 15 chronologies listed by Andy and me in The Date Being, and there's one or two more now since then, it was essentially, in some cases, consensus was what I said, rock solid. Everybody agrees, or almost everybody agrees, that the dates are this and this. In some cases, it's more like a majority, or maybe it's, out of 15 different chronologies, you have 10 different dates, but some of them are picked by more than one. So there's a little bit of judgment about the consensus, but you could probably come up with a consensus date based on the chronologies for just about all the cases. And I wanted to, and my question to myself then was, well, if we know when the cases took place, how does that match up to the publication dates? Obviously, the case always took place before it was published. That's pretty easy to conclude. But are there patterns of when these cases, what notes did Watson draw to write these stories? And so what I did was, because I love tables, I created a table for myself that listed every single story and had sort of three columns, the date of publication, the consensus date of the events, and the title of the story, and then sorted it different ways. So I was able to put out the tales so you can see by publication date sort of where they fall. You can see the order of the cases by consensus and see a sort of overall timeline for Holmes and Watson. And it's the same timeline that's in my new annotated, but it isn't laid out there like this. And then sort of also just for curiosity, did the cases come from specific months? And yes, they did. And many cases fell in January, very few cases in February, a whole bunch in April, and a whole bunch in July. Interestingly, August was a very popular month, September and October, not so many, December, not so many of the other months. Just interesting. Now, I'm hopeful that this data will lead some scholars to make something of it. I'm not trying to present any conclusions in that article. I'm just trying to say, look, there's some really interesting data here. Use it.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating, and for years I have passed out my Sherlockian card, my business card. It said the Baring Gould chronology on the back. And I'm now approaching the point where I need to reprint some cards, and I think I'm going to use the Klinger consensus as my guidepost here.
Well, you can call it the Klinger Peck consensus and make Andy happy. So
the KP, I like that. Very good. Well, yeah. So chronologies annotated. That sort of gets us to one of your more recent books. In fact, it just came out earlier this month, I think, in October. Which is it seems to me to be a real departure from things like Sherlock Holmes, from Dracula, because the subject is classic American crime fiction of the 1920s. And I love this book because I am such a fan of Charlie Chan and S.S. Van Dyne. And sometimes, I feel a little alone in my interest back in this era. But one of the things I was curious about is how did it come about? Why the 1920s in America?
Well, so that That's a good question, Vernon, and it is a bit of a departure. But in the course of writing some of the other anthologies that I've put together, in particular the anthology called In the Shadow of Sherlock Holmes, which is sort of classic Victorian detective fiction, and the one I just did called In the Shadow of Agatha Christie, which is Forgotten Female Crime Writers, I spent a good deal of time thinking about the history of crime writing and sort of how did we get to Sherlock Holmes and what happened after Sherlock Holmes. And had written in pieces essays about this and that. And by the way, this book is American. It is strictly American crime fiction. It is not British. Because I just didn't feel like I had the expertise, and our good friend Martin Edwards is much more of an expert on British crime fiction than I. But I thought it was really interesting to see sort of what happened. In America, in particular, crime writers forget that there's a lot more to the story than just Edgar Allan Poe. First, crime writing in America started well before that. Now, I say crime writing because it's not necessarily fiction. The earliest American crime writing was by ministers. It was the so-called execution sermons. So what would happen was John Smith was about to be hanged for his heinous crimes, and the minister would write up a story essentially about John Smith, the terrible things that he did, the lessons the congregation should learn on the eve of his hanging. These sermons became very popular. And they became so popular that I think there was actually some writing of sermons about people that maybe didn't even exist. Or let's say they filled in some episodes in the lives of the criminals that didn't really have a lot of substance to them, but they made for a great story. So there was a fictional element to some of these. After the church and the pulpit sort of spreading these, this spilled over into the secular world as well. And we had what are known as the broadsides. These are typically penny newspapers that were published on the eve of hangings. Sold in enormous quantities, and there's a huge collection of them at Harvard. But again, these were what we would call true crime, although there was certainly an aspect of embellishment of these. Well, the public's fascination with crime in America began with those and expanded. And so Poe was an important milestone along the way, but it was almost a blip that we had Edgar Allan Poe creating the Chevalier Dupin, an amateur detective, because what was much more popular were books like Reminiscences of a New York City Detective, Tales of a Boston Detective, and so on. Again, purportedly true stories written by this new phenomena, the official police force, and they captured the American public's attention. The first American crime novel was by Meta Fuller. It's called The Dead Letter. Came out in the 1860s. And very few have heard of it. Well after Edgar Allan Poe. And from there, there were other, the other great American writer was Anna Katharine Green, who wrote The Leavenworth Case and a whole bunch more books. But America kind of went into the doldrums after that. And while British crime fiction was very successful in America, with the exception of Mary Roberts Rinehart, there was basically nobody writing good crime fiction in America until the 1920s. And so that's why the 1920s, because the 1920s was an epochal change. It was suddenly Americans woke up and said, we can do this better than our British cousins, and began to write compelling crime fiction. So the book includes The first Charlie Chan, the first Philo Vance. Philo Vance, a now sadly forgotten detective who was immensely popular in the 1930s, topping the bestseller charts year after year. The first Ellery Queen. Ellery Queen was a blatant imitation of Philo Vance, but went on to have a much longer career than Vance because the writers Manfred Lee and Frederick Today were more flexible and able to adapt to changing times. The first Dashiell Hammett novel called Red Harvest, and the wonderful crime novel called Little Caesar, which became the great Edward G. Robinson film. And it was a fascinating project.
Yeah. What did you find in terms of, I'm sort of stopping myself in the middle of a question here. Christopher Morley observed years ago about the Sherlock Holmes stories that unless we explain to modern readers things like what a hansom cab was and what a basket chair was, there won't be any source. There won't be any easy access for them to figure it out. When you looked at these works from the 1920s, did you find similar things like that that needed modern explanation?
Oh, sure. I mean, for one thing, remember, this is Prohibition. So everybody had a bootlegger. Everybody was drinking, but it was illegal. So everybody was sort of kept on the quiet. There are sources of alcohol, things like that. So that's very different. The automobile. The automobile is a new thing. It's become very popular by the 1920s, but it's still relatively new. And so that's different. There are many things like that that needed explaining. Plus, I think the 1920s, everybody thinks of sort of the jazz age, or maybe they think of the stock market crash. It was an interesting time. Well, interesting is a euphemism. It was a very unpleasant time to be a person who wasn't white, who wasn't Anglo-Saxon, I guess is the right description. So the Irish had kind of gotten over their terrible discrimination problems, but we had, this is the time of the Johnson Act, when the United States government enacted a law forbidding the immigration of Asians.
Yeah.
And it was a time filled with, of course, discrimination against blacks and Jews and the like. And that sort of gets glossed over when we think back to the happy, frothy 1920s. Whoopee, the stock market was going through the roof. Everybody was rich. Everybody wasn't rich. Everybody wasn't having it easy. And a lot of those contrasts are on display in these books.
Yeah. So what's next beyond this? Because one of my favorites, you've touched, as I said, on some of my favorites here, particularly Philo Vance and Ellery Queen. But also, you know, my peculiar favorites are people like H.C. Bailey's detective Reggie Fortune, R. Austin Freeman's Dr. Thorndike. I mean, are
you getting into the English? I'm circumscribing myself here. So what's next is, I hope, a volume of the 1930s and eventually the 1940s and the 1950s and the 1960s and the 70s and the 80s. Somebody said, you can start on me for the 2010s. I'd love to make this a long-lasting series. I think we're moving ahead with the 1930s, and I picked out 7 or 8 books to consider. We'll end up with 4 or 5 of them for the next volume. Tough choices. I must say, one of the books that I had in this volume to begin with, I'll spend a minute or two talking about this, and then we ended up having to cut it because I couldn't get the rights, was The Tower Treasure, the first Hardy Boys mystery. And I took it very seriously. I did a very scholarly annotation of it, and there were, as I expected, things to be explained, things to be observed, things to be noted. I thought it was important to look at it because it's the gateway drug for a lot of mystery readers. They started with the Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew, which is the 1930s, and went from there to more serious mysteries. And there are noteworthy things in those books. But I'm not sure I'm going to include Nancy Drew in the 1930s now. And I mean, Mr. Pensler, our friend Otto, who wrote the introduction, was not very happy that I had put the Hardy Boys in the book, and he was thrilled when I took it out. He thought that that was, who reads juveniles? Who cares about juveniles? But I felt that it was important to look at it as a way sort of into the mystery genre.
Oh, yeah.
I don't have any Sherlockian projects in the near term, except for another Laurie King, Les Klinger anthology with some wonderful writers. It comes out in December. It's called For the Sake of the Game. And the writers include Peter Beagle, Greg Hurwitz, Weston Oakes, an amazing horror writer, Paul Wilson, Harley Jane Kozak, Reese Bowen, Reed Coleman, Tony Kellner, Doug Lyle, Jamie Fravoletti, Dwayne Swierczynski, Zoe Sharp, and a wonderful graphic by William Kotzwinkle and Joe Cervello, another in the Inspector Mantis series, if you read Trouble in Bugland and Double Trouble in Bugland. They're beautiful graphic stories about Holmes and Watson.
Well, that's fascinating. I suppose, you know, this has been a great conversation about chronologies, about annotating, about the 1920s. One last thing, you know, I feel like Inspector Columbo, like Lieutenant Columbo. One last thing. Frankenstein, you know, we're talking very close to Halloween here. You have annotated Dracula. You gave a great talk about the annotated Frankenstein, about Frankenstein at Bloomington. What's been, you know, the reaction to your annotated Frankenstein, and what have you observed in all of the reporting? The Times, the Sunday New York Times had a big story surveying Frankenstein through the ages. It's sort of a natural thing, but what's your current perspective about all this?
I think it's wonderful that Frankenstein is finally getting the attention that it's deserved. I mean, the book, this is the 200th anniversary of the publication of the first version of Frankenstein. And I think it's certainly not wrong to call it the first science fiction novel, the first great horror novel, many firsts associated with it. But it's a fascinating story. To me, what makes the story timeless is that it's a compelling story about taking responsibility for your personal actions. That's the core theme of the book, and that's the theme that makes it timeless. The science, well, we still don't understand how to create life, so it hasn't sort of gone into the past. It's not like reading a book about the invention of television that now everybody sort of takes for granted. But it's an incredible book, not only because of its timeless themes, but also because it was written by a 19-year-old. Who had great parents, fascinating progenitors, and was in the middle of a very stimulating intellectual environment. But nonetheless, she was 19 years old when she conceived this book and began to write it. She was 21 years old when it was first published. And that alone is just astonishing. And when you look at the book and sort of how it's echoed down 200 years, it's fascinating. Now, in addition, harking back to what we talked about earlier about texts, I spent a tremendous amount of effort in my annotations in this book in considering the differences between the 1818 text, the first publication, and the 1831 text that Mary Shelley revised substantially. And the short version of my comments on it is that it's important to look at the 1831 text because Mary Shelley was a very different person in 1831. She had lost three children. She had lost her husband, Percy Shelley. She had lost her closest friend, Lord Byron. She was a person buffeted, battered by fate and destiny. And she changed the book. She changed the book to make Victor Frankenstein also that kind of a creature. Instead of the guilty, almost evil person that he comes across in the 1818 text, he is a much more sympathetic character in the 1831 text. And that was fascinating to me.
Oh, what a wonderful insight. And how, I mean, you still think her relatively young age, how much she understood about human nature and was able to convey that. It's really something.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, the baying of the hounds would seem to indicate that we are at the end of our appointed hour here. Les Klinger, author and editor of classic American crime fiction of the 1920s, For the Sake of the Game, In the Shadow of Agatha Christie, Baker Street Reveries, and of course the annotated Sherlock Holmes, and so many other wonderful volumes. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Talking to Les is a bit like a literary roller coaster. You know, it's it's fabulous. It's always so much fun to talk to him. And I think one of the reasons why we wanted to get him on this program was because we both had experiences of talking to him at Bloomington. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we wanted to bring to our listeners. You know, for those people who sort of wonder about things like Sherlockian scholarship, you know, finding the words Sherlock Holmes and scholarship in the same sentence. And what's all this about? You know, there could be no better dive into that subject matter to see what the potential is and why it's interesting than talking to Les.
Oh, I know. It's absolutely astounding to hear the depth and breadth. I mean, even though he will demur and say that his knowledge of some of these other topics that he has annotated is not nearly as scholarly as others, well, it doesn't really matter in the long run, because the product that he's bringing forth to the reading public is something that is certainly memorable and comprehensive, and that other people just don't take the time to do. You know, being an annotator is it's a special affliction. And we're grateful that we have Les, who has such a broad array of interests that he's able to go down these various rabbit holes with Dracula and Frankenstein and Sandman and H.P. Lovecraft, parts one and two, as well as, of course, Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, and for those of our listeners whose fingers are itching towards that pack of unopened index cards, thinking to themselves that they too might wish to annotate some things, you could get no better guidance than Volume 66, Number 4, the Winter 2016 edition of the Baker Street Journal, in which Les lays out his entire process for annotating text in an essay entitled On Annotating Sherlock Holmes. Hmm. So there you are.
The annotator's annotator.
No.
Well, it is about that time. That's right. It is time to revisit the canonical couplet. You will recall that in the very last episode, we brought you a canonical couplet that went something like this. Those county magnates caused a lot of worry when Holmes went down to a holiday in Surrey. Bert, do you know which story that referred to?
Yes, that's the Gloria Fringe on top, I think.
Chicks and ducks and geese better scurry.
Yeah, that was it.
That, of course, was the Reigate Squire.
Oh, I'm wrong again.
Or the Reigate Puzzle, depending on which volume you have. And once again, we had a number of people enter, and we will turn to our amazing revolving drum here to come up with the appropriate number. And it looks like it is stopping on number 8. Number 8. And that number belongs to Mark Jones. Mark, congratulations. You are a winner. We will let you know exactly how to claim your prize. It's from something from the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere vaults. And that brings us around to the canonical couplet for episode 155. And here it is. The killer was a big, good-hearted dunce, as Beeswing in the bottle showed at once. If you think you know the answer to this canonical couplet, to the canonical story to which we refer, jot it down in an email, send it to comment@iheroofsherlock.com, and put canonical couplet in the title. Good luck.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a bit of sad news here. This is the final episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, when you will hear the Baker Street Journal as our sponsor. We, of course, are moving the BSJ over as our title sponsor on Trifles, which makes a lot of sense, since a lot of the things we talk about over there are things that are discussed or can be found in the Baker Street Journal. So listen for regular updates there. And of course, Wessex Press will remain with us here for the foreseeable future. They've been a wonderful partner and sponsor for us. And that means that we also have slots open to accept other sponsorships. So if there's something that you would like to advertise here on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, just know that we reach thousands upon thousands of sets of ears, severed and otherwise, in the Sherlockian world, and would be a great resource for you to share your message. So just get in touch with us at advertising@iheroofsherlock.com, or just leave us a comment or get in touch with us through our website.
Yes, if you want to be heard, you can't Van Gogh too far.
Boy. Well, it's once again David McGregor, Sherlock Holmes in the Case of the Elusive Ear.
Yeah, great idea.
You know, speaking of which, David actually got in touch with me just in the last week or so and let me know that there is a reading that is happening here in Michigan. So it's not necessarily going to be something that everyone can get to, but he said there is a new Sherlock Holmes play, Sherlock Holmes and the Adventure of the Fallen Soufflé, at the Chelsea District Library on Saturday, December 1st at 10:30 a.m. Play is going to be presented by actors who read their lines from the script, and then the audience will actually get to make comments and ask questions after the reading, kind of like an annotated version of the play. So it is free and open to the public on Saturday, December 1st at the Chelsea District Library in Chelsea, Michigan. Well, we continue to be free and open to the public here on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, and hope that you will convey the same to the people that you know and love in the Sherlockian world. Until the next time we're here on episode 156, I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Bert Walder.
The game's afoot.
I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.